Okay, well, welcome back to part two of our podcast of ethics. We're live again once today in St. Paul on June 18th, 2014, and also recording the podcast for on-demand listening. Those of you who are listening on the internet or to the podcast, during each hour of the program, I will give a couple of code numbers for you to write down that I use to take attendance in most states. So write those down and email them to me after the program. If you're listening to this program and you don't know where it came from, you can find it at richardclem.com, available for CLE credit, probably in Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, and probably a lot of other states. And we're covering the ABA model rules of professional conduct as adopted in those three states, but which are virtually identical to the rules adopted in about 40 other states. So this program should be relevant no matter where you are. The first hour of the program, we started talking a little bit about conflicts of interest. We got up through rule 1.7. Which simply states the general rule that you are not supposed to engage in conflicts of interest. Rule 1.8, we're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about, not because Rule 1.8 is more important, but simply because Rule 1.8 goes into a lot more specificity. So Rule 1.8 covers a lot of situations where you need a specific rule to deal with a specific situation, but don't get the idea that Rule 1.8 is more important. Because Rule 1.8 is actually less important, because it actually covers many of these situations are ones that you will never encounter in the practice of law, but they're just ones where you needed kind of a black and white rule, because the general rule didn't quite work. So some of these are common situations, some of them are pretty uncommon situations. The first rule in Rule 1.8 says that you should not enter into a transaction with a client if you get an interest adverse to your client. So in other words, you should not enter into a transaction to your client where you have a security interest, or you owe your client money, or your client owes you money, or any kind of situation where you have an adverse interest, not with some other, you know, not with one client being adverse to another client, but your client being adverse to you directly. Now, there are many situations, though, where you know, that's perfectly reasonable to enter into a business transaction with your client or have some kind of adverse interest to your client. So, for example, your client needs a lawyer, but they can't afford to pay you. While it would probably be reasonable for you to take a security interest in their property of some kind, well, that's permissible. Well, it's not permissible unless the following conditions are met. The transaction has to be fair and reasonable. Well, that's probably fair and reasonable. The client has to consent. Makes sense. And you have to advise the client in writing to obtain outside legal advice. So in that situation, before you're going to enter into a transaction with a client where you get an adverse interest, you have to send him a letter saying, please talk to an outside attorney. If they consent after that, then it's okay. Now, I had one attorney take the program who told me after the program that he got himself a private reprimand for violating this rule. And his story was kind of interesting. It kind of shows the kind of thing you have to watch out for. He was the in-house attorney for his wife's family business, so he was the general counsel for the wife's family business. So therefore, his in-laws were his boss, and therefore his client. So his in-laws were not just his in-laws, but his in-laws were his client. At some point during the course of the marriage, The wife's parents decided to loan them money to make a down payment on a house or something like that. Kind of a perfectly normal transaction, happens all the time. Certainly nothing unreasonable about it. And so they loaned them the money to make a down payment on the house, and and everything was good. Well, except this marriage was apparently not meant to last, and well, they wound up in the divorce court. As a result of that, this attorney lost his job. For some reason, his former boss didn't want him to work there anymore since he wasn't married to the daughter. It turned into a bitter divorce, as sometimes happens. And somehow along the way, either the wife or the wife's parents caught wind of this rule, and they filed a complaint with the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility. So they stormed into that office and they said, our attorney, who happened to be our son-in-law, but our attorney acquired an interest adverse to us. And it was horrible. You disbar him. So they asked him, was the transaction fair and reasonable? And they said, oh, yeah, it was fair and reasonable. Did you consent to this transaction? Oh, yeah, we consented to it. Then what's the problem? And they said, our son-in-law didn't advise us in writing to obtain outside legal advice. Well, and that's what the rule says. So I think the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility realized that they were getting sucked into a bitter divorce. But still, the rule's the rule. So he got a private reprimand out of that deal. So he could have solved that. So what he should have done was send a letter, saying, "Dear Mom and Dad, thank you very much for loaning us the money for the down payment of the house. We're going to live happily ever after thanks to your generosity. And by the way, you should obtain outside legal advice." But he didn't send that letter, so he got himself in trouble. So watch out for that. Anytime you enter into a transaction adverse to your client, you want to make sure that you do that. So that could come up fairly often. The next one, doesn't come up too often in my practice. Your millionaire client wants to give you a substantial gift. That's fine. That's perfectly permissible. There's no restriction on your clients giving you gifts. But first of all, you're not allowed to solicit a substantial gift. So I guess you can solicit a minor gift. Say, client, can you give me a donut? I guess that would be okay. If you say, hey, client, give me $1 million as a gift, you're not supposed to do that. But more importantly, where it comes up is the rule says you're not supposed to draft the instrument that puts that gift into effect. So normally they're talking about a will. You cannot draft a will in which you are the beneficiary of the will. But it could be any kind of instrument. So your elderly grandmother wants to give you a gift of $1,000. And so your elderly grandmother says, well, here, you fill out the check and I'll sign it. Then you're preparing the instrument, so you shouldn't do that. Now, there is an grandparent was not the best one, because there is an exception if the person giving you the gift or giving the gift to your close family members is a relative. And then it's okay. So you can draft the will for your parents, naming you as the beneficiary, and it's okay. You're not going to get yourself disbarred. But that's not quite the end of the story. The rule is pretty generous in that regard, saying that if you draft the will for a relative, well, then it's okay. You're not going to get yourself disbarred. But that's not the end of the story, because the other question is, well, what about the $1 million I was supposed to get from this will? Will the probate court really give it to me? And of course, that question is outside the scope of today's program, because we're just talking about the ethics rules. But keep in mind, in Minnesota and Iowa, that's a totally separate question of, I managed to avoid disbarment. But I'm not going to get the money because the probate court said it was invalid. Well, that's why it's instructive. If you're taking today's program for Wisconsin credit, you need to know the Wisconsin rule. But it's still instructive to look at the Wisconsin version of the rule of professional conduct, because in Wisconsin, the answer to those two questions is the same. So in other words, if you successfully avoid disbarment in Wisconsin, you can rest assured that the probate court will be applying the same test. So you don't have to worry about two different outcomes. So either you'll get disbarred and get nothing, or you'll keep your license and you'll get all the money in Wisconsin. So that's why it's instructive to look at the Wisconsin test, because these are based on old common law cases from the 1800s. So chances are the substantive law in Minnesota is pretty similar. So if you're a Wisconsin attorney, we should look at the test of what you need to do to keep yourself from getting disbarred in Wisconsin. But keeping in mind that even if you're admitted in Minnesota or Iowa or just about any other state, these same rules would apply when the probate court decides whether or not you're really going to get the money. So what are those tests? To get the money and to avoid Wisconsin disbarment, just like in Minnesota, the client needs to be a relative. But not just any relative, it has to be a relative such that you are a natural object of the bounty of the client. And that's a term of art from the law of trust and estate, saying that you're the type of relative who normally gets a gift of this type. So yeah, you're drafting a will for your parents and you're the sole beneficiary, so that's probably okay. You're drafting a will for your cousin and you're getting this entire estate. Well, you're probably not the natural object of that bounty. So in other words, natural object of the bounty means, you know, what you would get if there weren't a will, if it were an intestacy case. And similarly, the amount of the gift has to be reasonable and natural. So if you're getting $1 million from your third cousin, well, maybe not. There can't be any reasonable ground to believe that the instrument will be contested. So if you think there's a will contest lurking, well, then you should just avoid it entirely. And there can't be any possibility that the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar. Because as you know, we as attorneys are just held in very high esteem by everyone. Nobody would ever dream of thinking anything bad about a lawyer. Certainly nobody would ever tell a lawyer joke or do anything like that. Well, we need to keep things that way. So if there's any risk, you know, people learned that you were drafting this will where you were getting all this money. Well, people might start joking about that, telling lawyer jokes, and we don't want that to happen. So that's the final part of the test, is whether or not the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar. Well, you look at those tests, and so if your parents ask you to draft their will you get in trouble? Well, no. Will you get the money? Well, probably yes. But do you really want the probate judge basing his or her decision on things like whether or not you are the natural object of the bounty of the client, or whether the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar? Those are not very objective tests, and that gives that judge a lot of discretion. Don't draft wills in which you were the beneficiary, because it's just going to lead to trouble. Now, I always joke around, you know, that I've never had to worry about the millionaire client naming me as the beneficiary. But I mean, these issues do come up every now and then. I gave this program in a medium-sized Iowa city, and the local bar was all abuzz about a recent case in which, sure enough, some millionaire farmer died, and it was one of these millionaire bachelor farmers, and he had to leave his estate to somebody, and wound up going to the trusted attorney. Just based upon those facts, you know, you can tell there's obviously some issues of undue influence that were probably lurking there. So it was bitterly contested in this county, and the lawyers in town were still talking about it. But at least he had the foresight to make sure that he did not draft the will. He sent this client to another attorney in another town, and this other attorney drafted the will, because that would have been pretty much an automatic exclusion of him, and he would have gotten himself in trouble. And even so, like I say, there was a question as to undue influence. But he wound up prevailing, and the lawyers in town reported that he retired to Florida after doing that. No, that was the second thing he did. Retiring to Florida was thing number two. The first thing he did was buy a new pickup truck. One farmer's seminar I went to, they pointed out that in good years, the first thing that happens is the farmer buys a new pickup truck. So if you ever want to gauge the rural economy, you check the car dealers. They get the new pickup truck, then they get the new combine. But apparently lawyers follow that same rule. So this lawyer bought a new pickup truck and drove it to Florida. So it does come up, apparently. So you know, pay attention. But don't draft those wells, because even if it's those situations where it might be permitted, it's still fraught with peril. The next issue, I don't think it's ever come up in my practice, probably never will, but the next O.J. Simpson case takes place here in St. Paul, and the defendant is looking for an attorney, and they come into my office, and they want to hire me to take their case. But this is the crime of the century, but unfortunately this defendant doesn't have any money to pay me. So what they tell me is this is going to make a Hollywood blockbuster movie. So instead of paying you cash, I'll sign you over this movie deal that I'll be able to get out of. Well, unfortunately, I can't take that. I'll have to send them to somebody else because until a case is concluded, you may not receive literary rights based upon the representation. And the reason for that is because that's kind of an automatic conflict of interest. Because as soon as I enter into that contract with my client, then my interests are suddenly adverse to his. Because at that point, my client wants one thing and one thing alone, and that is to get off. Whereas I want the case to be as interesting as possible, so as to sell more books and sell more movies. So I can't do it. It's just a black letter rule. I guess the next one probably comes up more often, and you will get your money's worth out of today's program, because you just cut out this page and show it to your clients the next time they ask. You may not provide financial assistance to a client. And there's an exception for costs of litigation and so forth. So no matter how much of a hard luck story your client has, they come to you asking for financial assistance, you have to say no. So if you want, you can tell him, gee, I would love to, but here, look, I just went to the CLE today, and he said I'm not supposed to give you any money, so tough. So don't provide financial assistance to the client, other than that limited exception for cost of litigation. Your fee is being paid by somebody other than your client. Well, once again, Rule 1.2 says your client is always the person who makes important, or not important decisions, every decision. Your client is the decision maker. That does not change just because some third party is paying your fee. So if the insurance company is paying your fee, you still owe all of your loyalty to your client. You don't owe it to the insurance company. Or in the criminal defense context, I had a criminal defense attorney take the program, and he identified the person being referred to. A lawyer's fee is being paid by somebody other than the client. He gave me the name of that person. That name of that person was Mom. He represents the client, the defendant, and the check always comes from somebody called Mom. Well, Mom does not have any special say in how the case is carried out. It can't interfere with the lawyer's independence, and confidential information has to be maintained. Now, he said that not infrequently in that situation, he would get a phone call from Mom saying something like, can't you see to it that my son gets at least 30 days? He had to tell Mom no, because the client didn't want 30 days. The client didn't want to spend any jail time. So even though Mom was paying the bills, she did not. If the client said, please send me to jail for 30 days, well, then he would be bound to do that. But just because the person writing the checks said that, did not. And then finally, the client has to consent. Junior probably will consent, but you have to ask him, is it okay if Mom pays my bill? And he'll probably say yes. Another context where this could come up, though, is in the insurance defense context. And in the insurance defense context, you again have to ask your client, the insurance company is paying me. Is that okay? And I'm going to provide you. It won't cost you a dime. So is that okay with you? And normally they'll say yes, but I suppose they might say no. Well, once again in Wisconsin, that question is resolved a little bit more easily because the Wisconsin version of this rule makes clear that you don't have to ask them today for their consent. The fact that they consented back when they took out the insurance policy is adequate. And I think probably Minnesota would come down the same way. But if you did have that issue in some other state, that's probably a case where I would ask for one of those advisory opinions. But it is okay for your fee to be paid by mom or any other person as long as those requirements are met. The next rule, I don't think they really even need this rule in here, because it kind of makes common sense just under your general duties to your client. But the rule makes clear that if you're representing more than one party, then an aggregate settlement of the case has to be approved by all of the clients. Now, at first I couldn't think of any reason why that rule was in there because I was thinking in terms of the plaintiffs. You're representing both plaintiffs, and then it seems pretty obvious. I guess it's not quite so obvious if you're representing the defendants, because I had one attorney tell me the situation where this rule comes into play would be when she represented, she worked a lot for municipalities, cities, and in litigation cases, and she would often be brought in when the police department was getting sued for excessive force. So some police officer was being sued for excessive force. So the defendants were this officer and his boss, the city council. The city was getting sued for employment discrimination. So they were suing the individual who allegedly discriminated as well as the city itself. Well, it's not uncommon, she said, in that situation for the city council to want to settle it kind of as a business matter, be willing to settle it for the cost of defense. Whereas the individual defendant in that situation is sometimes very reluctant to do that because for them they kind of take it personally. So this cop is being sued for using excessive force and he doesn't think he did anything wrong, so he wants to go to trial and prove it. Whereas the city just wants to get rid of the case as fast as possible. Well, this rule says that in that situation, basically, that individual defendant does, in fact, have veto power. So if that situation arises, that individual defendant can indeed be stubborn and put the brakes on the whole settlement. And then she explained what she did in that situation. She would kind of tender the defense and... they would kind of tender policy limits kind of call the individual defendant's bluff because basically say, well, you're on your own after that amount. And then it would suddenly become a business decision for the individual defendant. But this rule, like I say, does say that the individual defendant does in fact have veto power in that situation. The next part of this rule, never do this. Don't ask your client to prospectively waive malpractice claims. Notice here, it does not say that that will be unenforceable, even though it probably will be unenforceable. Or it doesn't say don't enter into a contract in which your client waives malpractice claims. No, it says don't even ask. So don't say to your client, please don't sue me for malpractice. Don't say that because that's a violation of this rule. Now, you can't do that prospectively. You can do it for malpractice claims that arose in the past because as part of a settlement. So in other words, you committed malpractice, so you're going to pay a settlement to your client, and as part of that settlement, you want them to sign off saying they won't sue you for any more than what you're giving them. Well, that's permissible, but you can't ask them prospectively waive them. Similarly, don't ask your client not to turn you into the disciplinary authorities. Because number one, it will not work. They will do it anyway. Number two, it will simply give them ideas. So even if you didn't do anything wrong. And number three, even if you didn't do anything else wrong, it's a violation of the rules simply to ask them. So don't ask them to do that, because that'll just cause problems. You may not acquire a proprietary interest in a cause of action, subject to an exception, which kind of swallows up the rule. Actually, subject to two exceptions. First of all, so you can't own a piece of the case that you're suing about. You are allowed to have an attorney's lien. So somewhere in the Minnesota statutes, probably in the same chapter where it talks about mechanics liens, I'm not sure, but there's a section about attorney's liens that basically says you do have a proprietary interest in the cause of action. But that, just because that arises by operation of law, that does not constitute a violation, as long as, or even enforcing that lien. But the other exception is a reasonable contingent fee in a civil case. So obviously, a contingent fee in a civil case where you get one-third of the settlement, that's obviously a proprietary interest in the cause of action. But as long as you've complied with the other requirements about contingent fees, well, then that is okay. And finally, and this has been amended since I graduated from law school, so in the last 25 years or so, a lawyer may not have sexual relations with a client unless that relationship predates the legal representation. And in the case of a corporate defendant, that applies to the person supervising the attorney. And now finally, a little bit later on, we'll talk about the rule that says that conflicts of interest are imputed to other members of the firm. So we'll go into a little bit more detail about that. But basically, that is the case. Anytime you have a conflict of interest, that conflict of interest applies not only to you, but also to other members of your firm. So if you can't take the case, then your partner can't take the case. Or if your partner can't take the case because of a conflict of interest, then you can't. There are a few exceptions to that that we'll talk about later, but that's the general rule. And here, that rule applies to everything in Rule 1.8, except that last paragraph. That does not apply to your partners. It applies to you only. So, like I say, that's Rule 1.8, where we go into a lot of specificity about conflict of interest rules. But once again, keep in mind that the most common conflict of interest situations are actually addressed by Rule 1.7 and not by Rule 1.8. So keep, like I say, remember that 1.7 is the most important conflict of interest rule. At this point, I'm going to give what I think is the first code word of this portion of the program, of the second hour. And you'll start to see a pattern developing here. But the code word for this part of the first code word for hour two, for those of you listening on the podcast, is E as in ethics, 241. E241. E241 is the next code word for ethics. And that's the first code word of hour two of the program as we wrap up Rule 1.8. Moving on to Rule 1.9. Heretofore, the rules we've been talking about are basically the confidentiality and conflict of interest rules with respect to your present clients. The Rule 1.9 reiterates what your duties are to your previous clients, your former clients. And the main thing to keep in mind about your former clients is you don't have to worry too much about conflicts of interest with your former client. Rule 1.7 doesn't have a lot of application there. It might have some application, but most of the situations involving your former clients are actually resolved because of Rule 1.6. So most of the time you'll have to say, I can't take this case because of Rule 1.6, because of a former client. Because remember, under Rule 1.6, we decided that everything is confidential. Basically, anything that takes place during the course of a representation is confidential. Well, that confidentiality does not cease when the representation ceases. That confidentiality kind of persists forever. So therefore, you're always exposed to something confidential. So basically the rule under Rule 1.9 is if there's any possibility that that confidential information could be used against your former client in any way, then you can't take the new case. And because, like I say, everything is kind of confidential, that kind of resolves the situation like 99% of the time. So that resolves it most of the time. The other part of the rule says that if you've represented a former client, obviously you can't switch sides and represent somebody else in the same case or a substantially related manner. So you can't switch sides, obviously. But the general rule is that once you have access to that confidential information, then you're kind of tainted. So that's how it usually washes out. You're usually precluded from taking the new case because of the confidential information. Okay, as I mentioned, most conflicts of interest are imputed. And so Rule 1.10 goes into a little bit more detail talking about that. So in other words, the general rule is that if you are prevented from taking a case, that prohibition also applies to any other attorney working for the same law firm as you. Rule 1.10 goes into a little bit more detail and talks about how that rule affects you when you change jobs. So you get a new job. What happens to your conflicts of interest? Well, the general rule is that your conflicts of interest are your baggage, and you carry that baggage with you to your new employment. So, in other words, I was general counsel for Acme Widget Company. So therefore, I have a conflict of interest with respect to Acme Widget. I have access to all their confidential widget information. So therefore, I really can never take a case against my former client, the Acme Widget Company. Well, I get a job to work for you, and I come and work for you. Well, I bring that conflict of interest with me as my baggage. So therefore, while I am in your employ, you have that conflict of interest. And you, just like me, cannot sue the Acme Widget Company. Because you have that conflict of interest now as well. Well, that wasn't a very good deal for you, because it turns out Acme Widget was spewing out all kinds of defective widgets. People were injured. They were polluting the environment. And there's a lot of high-dollar litigation pending against the Acme Widget Company. And you want a piece of the action. So you kind of come to your senses and you realize that you don't want me working for you anymore. So you send me on my way and I no longer work for you. Well, at that point, I bring my baggage with me. I take it with me. And the Acme Widget conflict of interest has now left your firm. The conflict has left the building. So you can now bring that lawsuit against the Acme Widget Company, because I removed the conflict of interest from you by putting it back in my baggage. So the general rule is conflicts of interest follow me around and I take them to my new job. There are a couple of exceptions to that. First of all, and there's one exception to me bringing the conflict of interest to your firm, and that is if I wasn't general counsel for Acme Widget, I represented them on some minor and isolated thing way in the past. I don't know anything about the defective widgets. I just drafted a lease for them 20 years ago. Well, if it's a minor isolated matter, then it might be okay for you to take it. And you should look at the rule a little bit more carefully. But in general, it's not permitted. Now, there's also a question. Normally, once I leave your firm, I take that conflict of interest with me. Unless, while I was employed by you, I did share with you all the secrets of the Acme Widget Company and shared that confidential information. So if I left that information behind, then it might be different. But generally, like I say, you take the baggage with you. That baggage goes with you. But the general rule is imputed disqualification. Rule 1.11 talks about the special case of former government lawyers. And the reason why we have a special rule for former government lawyers is that if you took the general rules that we've discussed so far and strictly applied them, you would lead to some absurd results. So, in other words, I used to work for the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and I prosecuted cases. Well, who was my former client? Well, my former client was the state of Minnesota. I represented the state of Minnesota by prosecuting people. So if I went and looked at these rules in a very strict sense, well, I learned things while I was representing the state of Minnesota, so they're my former client, so I really can't sue my former client, so therefore I have to retire from the practice of law because I can never go up against my former client again. Well, that would be kind of a harsh result. So therefore, in the case, normally, if I worked for 3M or Acme Widget or somebody, they're my client, even though they're a big client. But in the case of a government entity, then we don't worry about who the client was, we don't worry about who my prior client was. We instead worry about the individual matters in which I was taking place. So if I worked for the state of Minnesota as a prosecutor, yes, I am still permitted to go into private practice and represent individual defendants who are going up against my former client, the state of Minnesota, but I can't take cases in which I personally participated as a prosecutor. So that kind of makes sense, because otherwise, prosecutors would be kind of unemployable in the private practice. So we need to, give them the potential to move to private practice. But that doesn't totally solve the problem, though, because there would still be some kind of significant barriers to my employment, especially if I was a prosecutor in a small county. So, for example, I am I get elected as the county attorney of Rock County, Minnesota. First of all, I'm guessing that's probably a part-time job. I don't know if they have a full-time prosecutor in a small county like that, but also there are not very many criminal defense firms in town. Maybe there's one or two. I decide to not run for re-election, and somebody else takes those duties, and then I retire, I don't retire. I go into private practice. I don't want to start my own firm, so I go to one of the firms in town and look for a job there. Well, I would be kind of unemployable if you strictly applied the rules, because I prosecuted every single case in the county. So therefore, I have gone up against every other law firm in town. So I was prosecuting the Smith case. So I go to Smith's lawyer and say, can you give me a job? And he said, well, I'd love to, but then we'd have a conflict of interest. So to ameliorate that situation a little bit, what the rule says is I can still go to work for Smith's law firm, even though I was personally prosecuting Smith. But number one, I have to be screened off from that case. There have to be measures in place to make sure that nobody talks to me about the Smith case. And number two, I cannot share in any portion of the fee from that case. And then the thinking is that, after a year or so of employment there, then these cases will work themselves through the system. But in the meantime, I am employable. So like I say, those are the rules for former prosecutors, basically, or somebody who works in kind of a litigation capacity or an adversarial capacity working for the government. The other part of Rule 1.11, so that portion of Rule 1.11 kind of gives a break to these former government people to make their life a little bit easier. The other part of Rule 1.11, though, imposes a duty on any former government lawyer. So there's, or for any former government employee, not necessarily a lawyer. So, for example, on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, I will take off my lawyer's hat and I go to work for minimum wage for Ramsey County as an election judge. So for that one day, I will be a county employee. I'll be on the public payroll as a government employee. So on the day after election day, this rule applies to me. What this rule says is that I, as a former government lawyer, cannot use confidential information that I gained during my government employment. Now, normally when we talk about confidentiality, we're talking about, you know, we as lawyers are talking about confidentiality, we're talking about that, you know, kind of attorney-client fiduciary responsibility. You know, this information is confidential because my client and I are on the same side and he shared this information with me. Here we're talking about a different kind of confidentiality. Here we're talking about confidentiality that arises for some other reason. So for example, you, before you went to law school, you worked as a file clerk at the IRS. And due to your photographic memory, you memorized every tax return that crossed your desk. So you know the exact income of everybody in town. Now you're a collections attorney, and that information is kind of useful to you. Well, you can't use that confidential information. It's confidential. The people didn't give it to you because they liked you. They gave it to you because they had to. But it was confidential because of some other law. So in my situation, for example, I'm looking for some defendant, you know, who is, I've been trying to serve this guy, and lo and behold, he's a registered voter in my precinct. So I'm looking through this book, and there's his name, here's his address. Well, I can't use that information because I think it's confidential. But to the extent that that information is confidential, I can't use that confidential information in my private practice because I'm a former government employee, and Rule 1.11 applies to me. Also, when you're a government lawyer, you're not supposed to negotiate for employment if you're with the people you're involved with. There's an exception for judicial law clerks, but they have to comply with some pretty strict rules. And then Rule 1.12 kind of says the same thing, but talking about the special case of government employees, namely former judges. And former judges obviously didn't have any former clients, but again, the test is they have a conflict of interest and they can't represent people in cases in which they previously served as a judge. But once again, a retired judge might be unemployable, especially in a small county, because of the imputed conflict of interest. So therefore, he can go to work for the law firms that previously appeared before him, as long as he is screened off from those particular cases. Now, even if you're not a former judge, Rule 1.12 might apply to you because that also applies to like former arbitrators or mediators. So if you're ever in one of those roles, you're kind of on the same footing as a former judge. Okay, let's see, we have about another 15 minutes in this hour of the program, and then we'll take another break before we, for those of you live, talk about bankruptcy today. Rule 1.13 talks about an organization being your client. Normally, talking about your duty to your client, usually kind of think in terms of that being an individual. But Rule 1.13 talks about some special rules where a corporation or some kind of institution is actually your client. This rule kind of reiterates the common law rule that if your client is an organization, well, then yes, your client is an organization. And you do not necessarily thereby represent individuals within the organization. You represent the organization, not the individuals. Now, you are permitted to represent individuals within the organization as well, but you always have to keep in mind that when you do that, then it is a case of joint representation. You are representing multiple people. You are representing the company and the company president, even though you're just one lawyer. So that's permissible, but keep in mind that there's always a potential for conflict of interest when you do that. Now, you do, under this rule, have an affirmative obligation that if somebody within the organization appears to be confused as to your role, you're representing the company and not the, you are the lawyer for the trucking company, but you're not representing the truck driver who was in the accident. Well, if that person is confused as to your role, then you have an affirmative obligation to clear that up. Now, your duty to your corporate client is to the corporation, not necessarily to individuals within that organization. So therefore, this rule goes on to say some interesting things about when you may or must have a duty to become a whistleblower. So, for example, I work for the Toxic Industries Inc. And among other things, they produce toxic waste, and they dump this toxic waste in aside some ditch. And well, you're not supposed to do that, it turns out. There's a law against doing that sort of thing, and it's a pretty serious violation. And there's $1 million a day fine for dumping toxic waste. Well, I'm working there, I'm a conscientious attorney, and I'm working for this company, and I'm working late hours, and I notice the toxic waste truck going out, and I realize that they're dumping this toxic waste into a ditch somewhere. I didn't even know they were doing that, but now I'm aware of it. So the next morning I go to my boss and I say, "Boss, the company is dumping toxic waste in a ditch. This is terrible." Well, then I've done my duty. And in an ideal world, after I do that, my boss will also be horrified and he will immediately put an end to this illegality. And life will be good once again. Well, unfortunately, the world does not always operate in an ideal fashion. So I go to my boss and I say, "Boss, they're dumping toxic waste out here. This is horrible." And my boss says, "Mind your own business." Well, what do I do in that situation? Because my boss told me to not do anything about it. But I know that my client is being harmed every time they dump the toxic waste out there. Because every time they do that, they are going to, there's a $1 million fine for doing that. And I don't want my client to get $1 million fine. And I also know that fugitives like that are always brought to justice. So therefore, I have an obligation to my client, the company, even though this individual, who happens to be my boss, told me otherwise, I have an obligation to my client to do the right thing. So the next morning, I go to the company president or to the board of directors, and I explain to them what's going on. And once again, in an ideal world, then everything is good again, and they stop dumping the toxic waste. My boss probably gets fired, and everything is good again. Well, once again, we don't always live in an ideal world. So I do that. I go to the company president. I go to the chief head honcho of the company and tell them that. And what do I get as a reward for doing that? Well, I get fired. Well, normally when you get fired, we will learn in one of the other rules, normally once you get fired, you have a duty to go home and stop representing your client. That's your normal obligation. But in this limited situation, this could be an exception to that. Because in that situation, I might have an obligation that, and don't do this lightly, don't do this without giving it a great deal of thought, but in that situation, I might have a duty to pick up the phone and call the EPA and turn in my former client. And the reason for that is not because I'm a vindictive person who is mad about I get fired, although that might have something to do with it. But the real reason I want to make that phone call is because I have this one last obligation to my client to try to put an end to this illegal activity. because I know that if I make that phone call to the EPA, two things are going to happen. One is my client will get caught red-handed and they're going to pay $1 million fine for doing that. But on the other hand, because they got caught red-handed, well, at least that's going to put an end to this toxic dumping, and there will be no $1 million fine tomorrow or the day after that. So like I say, don't do that lightly, because obviously you're also violating your client's confidentiality in doing that. If they were causing substantial harm to the environment by doing that, or causing death or serious bodily injury, then you would have been able to fit it under that other exception. But in that scenario, you might have the obligation to do that. But like I say, don't do it lightly because, if your sole motivation or your sole thing you get out of it is the revenge against your former boss, well, then that's not the right reason for doing it. So like I say, you might have an obligation to be a whistleblower. Hopefully that doesn't come up too often, and hopefully most of us spend most of our time in that ideal world where our boss actually goes along with the right thing to do, but those other times, that's what you have to do. Rule 1.14 talks about another special class of clients, and that is the client with a diminished capacity. And I think it's time for another code word. So our next code word for this portion of the program is E293. E as in ethics, 293. E293 is the second code word for hour two of the program. Rule 1.14 talks about a client with diminished capacity. Because as we learned back in Rule 1.2, your client is always right, by definition. So if your client wants to do something stupid, well, that's your client's decision to do something stupid. And if they persist in their stupidity, you might want to, quit. But you can't go behind their back and try to prevent them from doing things. So your client gets an email from somebody saying that they just won the European lottery, or their dearly departed relative in Nigeria just passed away, and they're going to inherit all of this money, and they have to send some money there first. So you explain to your client, well, no, that's a scam. There's not really any money waiting for you. They're just trying to steal your money. Because you're a competent lawyer, you explain that to them. But they just will not listen to reason. So they're going to, they announce to you that they're going to go down to the Western Union office right now because they have to send this expense money to their cousin, the prince, to take care of some of these expenses. And they just won't listen to reason. Well, there's really nothing you can do at that point. Other than you can say, I quit, but you can't try to thwart their actions. You can't run down to the Western Union office and throw yourself in front of the door to keep them out, because Rule 1.2 says that it's your client's decision. Unless your client is suffering from a diminished capacity of some kind. So not just because they're a foolish person in general, but they are suffering from medical issue. They're suffering from a diminished capacity as a result of mental or impairment or age. Minority, you're the appointed attorney to a child. Well, in those cases, if they're suffering from some identifiable case of diminished capacity, then you can take actions to thwart their stated wishes. And they are not always right. And 1.2 does not apply. So this rule says that in those situations, if there's a risk of substantial physical, financial, or other harm, then you may take reasonably necessary protective action to protect their interest. Even though under Rule 1.2, normally they would get to make that decision. Here you get to make that decision. And even though that there might be confidential information involved, So you may violate the confidentiality in that situation. So if your elderly client, because of dementia, is about to send money to the client or to the person in Nigeria, well, in that case, you can talk to the family members and say, Grandpa, maybe we have to talk about, some kind of, guardianship or something. So in those situations, that's also an exception to confidentiality, in addition to being an exception to Rule 1.2. Now, this rule does not say that you have to do anything in particular, because this rule is merely stating that it's an exception to Rule 1.2 and an exception to Rule 1.6. So it does not say you shall take protective action. However, under Rule 1.1 that says you have to be a competent attorney, well, I think your general duty of competence in that situation would be, if your elderly client is about to send money to Nigeria, well, maybe you as a competent lawyer do need to fling yourself in front of the Western Union door. But like I say, you're not required to do that under this rule, but your general duty of competence might say that you're required to do that. Finally, Rule 1.15 talks about safe keeping a client's property. Yes, it will be finally, because we just have a few more minutes. Safekeeping a client's property. The general rule here is that anytime money or property comes into your possession during a representation, you have to treat it with care. You have to use reasonable care. In fact, I think the rule says something to the effect that you have to, personal property has to go in a safe deposit box or other place of safekeeping, kind of generally depending on what's reasonable for the situation. But most of Rule 1.15 spends its time talking about your trust account. And so we'll talk about that in a little bit of detail, but we're not going to get into the full detail of it, because in the very nut and bolt kind of requirements about what records you need to keep for your trust account and what kind of documents you have to have and so forth, they are covered in a separate document which is on the Minnesota Supreme Court website. And I have a link to it here, and that has the real specific requirements of what needs to be in your trust account records and so forth. The in Iowa, it's a separate document, and that the Iowa version is also linked here. So look at those for the exact requirements of what needs to be in the in your trust account records and so forth. So we'll kind of talk about it in general terms, but like I say, it gets into a little bit more specificity. The general rule on trust accounts, though, is that money belonging to a client needs to go in your trust account. And there's basically zero exception to that rule. Money belonging to the client goes in the trust account, period. There are a couple of exceptions to the corollary to that rule. The corollary to the rule is that money belonging to you does not go in your trust account. So in other words, you can't commingle the money. The trust account has to be exclusively client's money, never your money. Your money can be in there in two situations. Those two situations are, number one, money held jointly between you and the client. So in other words, a settlement check in a civil case. You get this $9,000 check, $6,000 of that belongs to the client, $3,000 belongs to you, but there's only one check. Well, that goes in the trust account, and the rule being that it has to be promptly dispersed thereafter, and you have to have records of that. The only other time money belonging to you can be in your trust account is that if it's a reasonable amount necessary to cover bank service charges. So in other words, the bank is permitted to charge a service charge for trust accounts. So they could charge a $20 per month service charge, and therefore it's reasonable for you to keep $20 of your money in the trust account to cover that. Or the bank, it's reasonable for you to keep $40 in there to cover the service charge for the next 2 months. Or it's reasonable to keep $100 in there to cover it for the next 5 months. And in fact, somebody told me that somebody from the Iowa trust account people said that $100 is kind of the presumptively reasonable amount. So I don't know if there's a set amount in other states, but $100 is basically a reasonable amount to keep in your trust account. Well, but it's not reasonable to keep $1,000 in your trust account because you're not going to have that much service charge. Well, that could pose a little bit of a problem to some people because some people are just not very good at math. And therefore, what they want to do is just kind of keep a cushion in there. And that's perfectly permissible in your personal bank account to keep a cushion to cover little errors in your mathematics. So if you you write a check for your electric bill for $101, well, it's a big problem if you only have $99 in there, but it's not a problem if you have a cushion and you have $1,099. So, but you can't do that with your trust account. So the moral of the story is you just have to be good at record keeping. And you have to keep those accurate records because you never want to have an overdraft in your trust account. And you cannot avoid that by keeping a cushion in there. Now, is that rule fair for us small practitioners? Well, no, it's not. Because, the big law firm downtown, they have money going through their trust account every day in large amounts. So if they make a math error and they overdraw one of their sub-accounts by a little bit, well, they always have money passing through there because they're such a big firm. But for you or me, sometimes our trust account balance is close to zero. So that's just not fair, but that's the way it is. Like I say, you never want to have an overdraft in your trust account because there are rules governing trust accounts. And one of those rules is, the rules for the bank, that is, and one of those rules is that if there is ever a overdraft in your trust account, no matter how innocent, they are required to inform the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility. And you probably don't want one of those notices being sent out because you probably have some explaining to do. So you want to keep that from happening. The other interesting thing about trust accounts is, yeah?
Doesn't an overdraft trigger all kinds of investigations?
I would certainly guess so.
Because you have to keep a general ledger for the trust account, then you have to keep a ledger for each client.
Right, yeah, and that's outlined in that separate document here. So, but yeah, it's going to trigger that. Now, it could be innocent. You settle the case against, the Acme Insurance Company that's been in business for 100 years, and they send you a settlement draft, and you deposit that in your trust account, and you disperse the money in good faith, and then the next morning you learn that that company went out of business, and that check is no good. So it could be an innocent situation like that, but that notice will go out, and I'm sure they will come down and want to inspect your trust account records and make sure everything is absolutely perfect. So number one, keep your records absolutely perfect. But number two, don't bounce checks if you can possibly avoid it. But like I say, it could happen in some situation like that. And like I say, the big firm downtown, they don't have to worry about that because they have, they have millions of dollars coming in and out of their trust account every day. But it's us small guys who have to worry about that. The other thing to keep in mind about the trust account is normally when I talk about trust account, we're talking about your IOLTA account or your pooled trust account. IOLTA account stands for Interest on Lawyers Trust Account, or Minnesota sometimes called LTAB account, Lawyers Trust Account Board. In Minnesota, you are, and Iowa and Wisconsin, you're required to have a pooled trust account where the interest earned on the trust account is picked up on a monthly basis and sent to the state where it's used for some public purpose. In Minnesota, that's used to compensate the victims of dishonest attorneys. In other states, it might be used for other things. The thing to keep in mind is that that's generally small amounts of money. So you know, my trust account this month generated, you know, a whopping 2 cents in interest because it was a big month. And, you know, your trust account, you have a big firm, you probably had, you know, 42 cents interest in your trust account this month. You know, so these amounts of money, they're not really that big a deal. But we have to keep in mind that that 2 cents really belongs to my client, and that 42 cents really belongs to your client. So if you are handling a large amount of money for a long enough period of time where you have a non-trivial amount of interest, you're really obligated to put that into a separate account of which your client is the beneficial owner. But I've never had occasion to do that because my clients don't have any money. But you do want to keep that in mind. Now, if the bankers of the state want, like I say, in Minnesota, it goes to the client security board that uses that money to help out the victims of dishonest attorneys, which is a laudable goal. But if the bankers of the state decided to put the client security board out of business, they could easily do so overnight. Because the rules governing the banks say that the bank has to make that monthly remittance of interest to the state, which I'm sure they love doing. You know, U.S. Bank sends over 2 cents from my account. You know, I'm sure that's they enjoy doing that. But if they wanted to stop doing that, the rules permit them to charge a service charge on my account and to make that remittance to be net of the service charge. So they calculate the interest on my account this month. It comes out to 2 cents. They apply the reasonable service charge of $20. So then they calculate how much money they're going to send to the state. Well, 2 cents minus $20, oh, that's a negative number. So they don't have to make a remittance this month. And instead, I have a service charge of $19.98. And you have a service charge of $19.41. And Fagry and Benson has a service charge of, you know, they generated a lot of interest this month. They had $4 interest, so they have a service charge of $16. And I don't know, maybe some firm has more than $20 a month interest, but I kind of doubt if there are very many. So if the bankers of the state wanted to assert their rights to collect a service charge, they would put the client security board out of business overnight. It's good for the client security board that they don't do that, but it's also good for us because that would be kind of an accounting nightmare. Because now you can put that $100 in your trust account confident that there will hardly ever be any service charges other than maybe for check printing or something. But if they were taking out $19.92 every month, eventually you would forget to make that deposit and you would run out. So, well, actually, I see I've gone over time a little bit, so don't worry, we'll make it up to you later this afternoon. But that concludes hour number two of Ethics 2014.